Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Most Merciful, I'd like to welcome you, dear viewers, to our program, In the Light of Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May Allah's peace and blessings be on each and every one of you. As you all know, this program is dedicated to you, the viewers. It is a means of answering your questions, questions that you have, which you can't find anybody around you to answer for you. Queries, discussions, comments, we are perfectly happy to receive any of them, and we will try to answer them to the best of our abilities. Anyway, let's carry on to some more questions from Fahad. Fahad writes in, please give us your views on the practice of mutilating women in East Africa. Is it legal or mubah or what? Well, mutilating women, meaning circumcision of women, I guess genital mutilation, and this is also in Egypt, practiced in Sudan. What does Islam say about it? Well, of course, Islam is opposed to it. The practice as it is done in these countries is in fact mutilation. And Islam is 100% opposed to it. It is harmful to the women. So many women, you know, die in the process. Huge infections, you know, all kinds of devastating consequences. Does Islam support or allow female circumcision? Yes. But in a very limited or at a very limited scale. Prophet Muhammad found women in Medina doing this, and he told them to be very limited in their practice, taking only a small, you know, portion from the end of the clitoris. This is all that is really permissible from the Islamic perspective. So it has no more impact on the feelings of the woman than a circumcision of the male has to the male. This is the basic practice which is permissible in Islam. Now, as we said, what is going on in Egypt and Sudan and other West African countries, and this is something inherited from pre-Islamic times, which involved an extreme view of trying to ensure the virginity of the woman involved. This is an extreme approach to it. And Islam, as I said, because of the harm which comes from all of this practice, mutilation, genital mutilation, Islam prohibits it. Our next question, which is from Brother Muhammad Ali, he writes saying, what is the Islamic ruling on slavery? How many rights do slaves in Islam have? And is slavery in Islam the same as slavery which developed in the West? Well, Islamic ruling on slavery is that people are not on their own able or allowed or permitted to capture anybody else and make them your slave. You know, this is the normal route. How were people made slaves? They were captured. Forces of some countries moved into other countries, captured people and turned them into slaves. Islam doesn't permit this. You know, fighting, slave wars where people are just fighting to capture chunks of other populations and turning them into slaves, this is not from the Islamic way. If some Muslims were involved in it historically at some points in time, they did it wrongly. It's not from Islam. Now, the principle of slavery itself, does Islam cancel it, prohibit it, whatever? No, it does not cancel it. Where there is benefit in the society from it, Islam will permit it. Where it is harmful, it will not permit it. It is something which existed all around the world. Islam didn't introduce it. They were not the first to do it. What Islam did was it modified it. Something like polygamy. Polygamy existed. Islam didn't invent it, it modified it. So slavery came under a series of laws from the Prophet ﷺ designed to put that person who is in a position of slavery in a respectable position in the society, a relatively acceptable position in the society, that their rights were preserved, and also it put in the law, part of the distribution of zakah is to free the slaves. So it was geared, it was set up in such a way as to remove slavery from the society. But where there were circumstances where that was the best option, then Islam permitted it to take place. For example, in those days when they fought, enemy populations that were captured, or enemy soldiers that were captured, what do? With these people, the other societies, maybe they jail them, maybe they kill them, whatever. In Islam, okay, you're not going to be killing people left and right. In this regard, where people have surrendered, you've taken their countries or their areas or whatever, then those people, what Islam did was they brought those that were captured in battle to the Muslim community and put them in the positions as slaves within different families in the Muslim community. So it became a means of absorbing these people now into the fabric of the Muslim society. A man who has a slave girl and a slave girl gives birth to a child for him, that child is automatically free, she cannot be sold, and that way she is absorbed into the society, into the family, children, the numbers of Muslims are increased, raised as children, as the son of the master, carrying his name and everything else. So what Islam did was it regulated and it removed from the system of slavery the basic harms that existed there, where a master was free to do anything with a slave. He could mutilate them, he could kill them, he could do anything. Islam did not permit that. Those who harmed their slaves would be themselves harmed. And the Prophet ﷺ told people, do not call him my slave. Forbade the use of abdi, you know, which is my slave, or amati, my female slave. They were prohibited from using these terms. Better to say ghulami, my young man, my young woman. These things, jariyati, you know, these things were used instead of the term my slave girl, my slave male, right? So Islam tried to regularize it, you know, add principles which would protect the rights of people involved, etc. And it tried to eliminate it through the process of distribution of zakah, freeing people. And it also gave the slave the right to earn his own freedom, what is known as mukataba, where the slave makes a request for seeking his own freedom. He works outside of the work for his master, he works on the side, and he sells whatever products he has or does whatever he does. He gains money, he's able to buy his own freedom. That's something which was unheard of in other societies, where a slave could actually become free and exist within the society. Islam promoted that, and furthermore, what you find is that some of the leading scholars of the first generation were former slaves. When we look into the books of hadith, the hadith which are conveyed to us, most of the people who conveyed it were former slaves. Slaves of scholars from among the Sahaba or the Tabi'in, they're slaves who became themselves knowledgeable, who became free and taught. You know? And furthermore, if we look at the Abbasid era, empire, you find the majority of the Abbasid rulers were the sons of former slaves, slave girls. You know, so the idea that the ruler of a country was the son of a slave girl is something inconsiderable. You know, you could not consider it in other societies where slavery existed. A slave is a slave is a slave. It can never be anything but a slave. Can never rise to be anything, you know, beyond that status of servitude. Whereas from the Islamic perspective, it was a means of absorbing populations, and it did not stop people from rising and becoming leading scholars, leading figures, and even rulers of countries. Question from Aisha. She writes, we know that music or singing is a part of the ibadah of the Yahud and the Nasara. That's the Jews and the Christians. One of their evidences is taken from the Psalms. we say we believe in the books of Prophet David. How do we reconcile this from a Dawah perspective? So how can we be opposed to music? And there were prophets known for their music. You know, in fact, the Prophet ﷺ spoke about the flute of Dawood, David. Well, we can simply say that music in Islam was prohibited in particular forms. Music, which is just the voice accompanied by the duff or a hand drum type instrument, is permissible in Islam. Times of celebration, the Eids, etc., marriages, it's permissible. Now, folk singing, etc., where people get together, families get together, or the tribe, or whatever, the men may sing and dance, women amongst themselves singing and dances, this is permissible also. But now, what we look at, when we look at modern music and its use, we find that it is mostly corrupt. And where, you know, the rock bands have been brought into churches, and this is supposed to be now worship of God, where people are involved in all kinds of, you know, music and dance and song and this kind of thing. Of course, this is now evil. This is satanic. Yeah, and this is not from Allah. It distracts people from the worship of Allah, where they may feel this sense of spirituality or whatever from the music, etc. But the reality is that it's not true spirituality. I mean, what they're experiencing are probably things from the jinn, not from Allah. So Islam, the Islamic position with regards to those texts which refer back to earlier prophets, that it may have been permissible for that prophet at the time, and later on prohibited. You know, prohibitions and permissions have gone through different phases, even during the life of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. You know, certain things were initially prohibited to a certain level, and then it was increased, its prohibition was increased as time passed. So we don't look at it as an excuse or a principle by which now we open up the door for any kind of music. Now the next question, which is from Sister Samina, she writes and says, what is the Islamic position on birth control pills? Is it haram or is it makruh? Birth control pills. Well, birth control pills, you know, which are really, if we take them as conception control, they're stopping conception, as long as there's no harm to the male or the female, then it is permissible, right? Islam permits it. But where there is harm, if it's birth control means you're killing fetuses and things like this, then we would say it's not permissible Islamically. It could be haram. The idea of limiting one's children and only having 1.5 children, if possible, where it is looked at as a kind of ideal, where we don't look at big families anymore as being good, it's looked at as a liability, it's not as harmful to the society, etc. So people tend to cut things down to basics. One child, 1.5 children, 2 children max. Now, this attitude, of course, Islamically is not good. Prophet Muhammad ﷺ encouraged us to have as many children as we can. You know, so there's a general encouragement for increasing the numbers of Muslims. We should also mention that if there is harm coming from the birth control pill, if it's established that it's going to cause cervical cancer for the women, or, you know, a variety of other things, then Islamically it would not be permissible also. Okay, we have a question on inheritance. Now, this question was directed to us by Talib al-Din. He said, inheritance, what is the ruling on a Muslim child inheriting monies from an insurance policy of a non-Muslim parent at the same at the time of the parent's death? Inheriting monies from an insurance policy. Of course, insurance policies, as they exist in the Western system, are not permissible Islamically. So to take wealth from that would be not permissible. But depends on the program. You see, some of these may be connected to jobs where the job provides a certain amount. The certain amount is taken from the salary of the worker, and this is given back to them in the end as some kind of benefit. So in this way, this type of insurance would be acceptable Islamically, as long as the interest element is excluded, because really all of these practices will have a degree of interest in them. So you can work out the percentage that the interest plays in the overall funds of the company, and then from your funds, whatever you receive in salary, etc., it should be purified of that amount of money. It should be given to some needy circumstances, emergency circumstances, or it may be given to do some community beneficial projects like building toilets for a bathroom, for a school, Muslim school or masjid, etc. You know, something which is not looked at as being pleasant. That's the area basically where women may. That's the area basically where such monies, which are from interest, may be given in order to get rid of it. It shouldn't be given to an individual personally as a means of charity, because it is filth. The next question, which is from Sister Khadija, she writes, what do you think of Muslim women who place so much emphasis on hijab but do not pray, like Malay women, but also other communities of Muslim women who don't dare go out in public without hijab, but neglect salah, turning the hijab into a costume? It would include men doing so also. Well, of course, this is something abhorrent. It's hypocritical. It is riya, shirk, where a person is seeking the pleasure of others, admiration of others externally, with some religious act. You know, it is religiously an obligation on women to cover themselves. So if a person covers themselves, not because they're doing it to please Allah, but to please people, then it becomes a form of riya, you know, a form of showing off, which whose consequences are very serious. If it's the main religion of the person, then they become disbelievers. If it is an occasional act that they've done, then this destroys the value of the deeds that they've done. So the rites of prayer, they should be learned, should be taught, strongly taught. But at the same time, the hijab should also be taught. You know, because some people go to the other extreme where they say, you know, better to pray, leave the hijab, you know, it doesn't matter, hijab's not so important, etc. Most important that they pray. Put the hijab on when you're praying, but after that, you know, you can, you can't, whatever. But in both cases, really, they're turning hijab into a kind of costume to be used at a particular circumstance to get certain things done, or to get the admiration of others, to win confidence in others, etc. So this mode or this way is not a good way. It is rejected by Islam. We should not imitate the non-Muslims in their dress or their customs, as long as they go against Islamic teachings, etc. With that, dear viewers, we'd like to thank you for being with us in this segment of our program. I should mention to you that you may write in your questions to In the Light of Islam, P.O. Box 111, Sharjah, or you may fax them in to my office in Sharjah, 06-5323-724, or you may email them to me at intheLightofIslam@bilalphillips.com. With that, dear viewers, we'd like to thank you for being with us in this segment of the program, In the Light of Islam, and we hope that you will continue to follow the program as it unfolds throughout the year. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.